You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
It was hidden beneath the waves for hundreds of years.
After being saved by the community, what can the Sande wreck tell us about life on the seas in the 16th century?
It's another nautical-themed Time Team podcast.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Time Team podcast with Helen Geek and Martin Williams.
Yeah, special edition indeed. Following our exploration, you're a member of the Mary Rose a few months ago now, we sat down for a chat about another ship investigated by archaeologists.
Yes, and initially this conversation was supposed to be a short chat as part of a different podcast, but it was so interesting that we've decided to devote a whole episode to it. So in February 2024, a wooden shipwreck was revealed on a beach in Orkney, and people on the island of Sande originally believed it might have been dislodged from the seabed in violent storms.
Yeah, and it seemed to be old, like really old. Its timbers were held together with wooden pegs, which was kind of common in the 16th century. But that's pretty much all anyone knew about the Sande wreck until now.
Wessex Archaeology have been working with the community and believe they've worked out the identity of this mysterious ship. Ben Saunders is Senior Marine Archaeologist at Wessex. Hi, Ben.
Hello, Helen. How are you doing?
Good to have you with us.
Really good to have you with us. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Let's clear up a few things here then, because this mystery is tantalising and I can't wait for you to reveal the identity of this ship in just a second. But first, let's get some things straight. So some people thought, oh, maybe this ship was sort of out at sea. It had become dislodged in the storms and then it had washed up on the beach. But that's not true, is it? So how did it actually arrive on the beach in Sande?
Yes, that is what we originally thought when we started to work through it, but actually it was quite far up in the intertidal zone. It was quite heavily buried within the intertidal sands. What we think happened is that this sort of long period of stormy weather coming from a certain direction meant that the intertidal sands got scooped away and scraped away by the waves and by the wind, and just to reveal the shipwreck, which then became somewhat more mobile and started to slide down the beach. And at that point, we were needed to go up and help the islanders recover the timbers from the beach.
How much of the ship survived?
So the piece we had was 10 metres long by 5 metres in width. And from the initial work that we'd done, one of the farmers recovered and in one of the timbers and took it to his weighbridge to find out how heavy it was. And from that, we could work out that there was roughly 10 to 12 tonnes worth of material there.
Wow.
And it's a large piece of shipwreck, but it's not actually, in terms of the overall size of the ship, which we were able to work out approximately, it's not actually that big a section of the overall ship. It's probably less than 5% of the vessel. It's the lowest part of the hull, right down at the keel. And it's also the sort of centre part of that. So not near the bow, not near the stern, but from the very midships area. You've not got any curve on the timbers starting to shape up into either the bow or the stern. So you really are looking at the very lowest part of the very centre of the vessel.
So you've got a big ship on your hands. You've got a little bit of it that's appeared there on the beach. It's a collection of timbers at the moment. How do you go from that to then determining its actual identity?
I mean, this is very much the sort of the issue we had at the start is all we have are the timbers themselves. There were no artifacts, there was no other material, there was no cannons or other material that would really help to narrow down the identity of this vessel. So all we have are the timbers that are there and the structure they're laid out within the ship. And that is where we have to start looking at techniques like dendrochronology to try and narrow down the age of the ship, the time period when the timbers were growing and were becoming as trees. And we also then want to start looking at the wreck corpus around Orkney, which has been quite well researched in the past, to start then seeing which other ships it could be. So you start looking at size of vessel, you start looking at the construction styles that you can see within the piece of wreck we have, and hope to be able to narrow it down to a number of vessels, ideally just one.
There must have been hundreds or even thousands of shipwrecks around Orkney in, I don't know what we're talking about yet, I want to say in the past, but obviously, you know, as us archaeologists say, many years ago. What was the list out of which you had to pick, though? It must have been hundreds or thousands of ships that were lost over the centuries of having these huge wooden ships.
Absolutely. And I mean, so we're very fortunate that there was a lot of work previously done around Sandy, initially by Alan Braby, who is an independent archaeologist based out of Edinburgh now, but spent a lot of time in Sandy in the 80s and 90s. And then by the Sandy community, in particular, Myra Stockton, has done a huge amount of work looking at the known wrecks within the waters around Sandy. And so we started off with a list of around 270 that are known to have been wrecked and recorded as wrecked in Sandy or around Sandy. That's not to say that there are other wrecks that would have been not recorded, although once you start to get beyond the middle of the 18th century, the recording of wrecks becomes more standardised, it becomes more important, and more of those records survive as well. So we've got very few recorded wrecks from 1500 through to 1650 or so. A lot of those are coming out of the Netherlands or coming out of the Baltic states and coming up through the Faroe Gap and out into the North Atlantic. But beyond sort of 1700 or so, you really start to get a multiplication of numbers of shipwrecks, not just because there is more shipping, which there is, but because they're getting reported and they're getting recorded.
Is that because of insurance? Is that because of something really boring like insurance rather than something really exciting like shipping and trade?
It is a mix of the two. So yes, Lloyd's Register and Lloyd's Insurers are set up in the mid-18th century partly because there is a large number of shipping, but also because there's a lot of losses. And that's just because ships they're well built, but also they are going out into areas that they haven't necessarily been to before. And yes, insurance is a big part of why this material is getting reported. It's also because the people who recover the material want to be able to sell it and want to be able to get the money for doing the salvage work. So it goes through the courts of admiralty so they can enable them to get that money. And also you have an increase in bureaucracy at this point. The British state is trying to record this sort of material, particularly with the large-scale wars that are going on. They want to know the amount of trade, the amount of vessels and the size of vessels and where they're going so that they can adequately protect them through convoy systems, which begin to be used in the Seven Years' War, 1756 to 63, and then are definitely in use within the American Revolutionary War.
What data are we talking about? What were the results from the dendrochronology?
We took 19 samples from the various timbers spread across the framing timbers, the big sort of rib timbers of the ship, and across the planking. And that was done with our colleagues at Dendrochronicle, Dr. Coralie Mills and Hamish Darra, who took the samples and then assessed and analysed them over the course of the last 6 months or so. And from that, they were able to create a site chronology from 14 of those samples. The other five, they couldn't quite get to fit. They didn't have enough ring count or just didn't fit quite well enough. And that created a site chronology for the ship. And then you can start comparing that to regional chronologies because it's all about the conditions that the trees are growing in. And it gives you a location for that growth, not just a date. It gives you a provenance for the timber as well, which is incredibly useful, incredibly powerful for what we want to do with it in terms of the identifying the ship. The earliest definite date we had is for a timber that goes all the way to bark edge, so you can get the season of felling of that timber. There were five or six of those within the samples we had, and the earliest was spring 1748, and the latest was spring 1762. You add in the other timbers and you have a range definitely going as far as 1764 and probably going a bit further into the 1770s, maybe into the 1780s as well. There's an uncertainty within that because you have a ring sequence that doesn't go all the way to bark edge. You potentially have it going into the sapwood, and then you have to add in an unknown range, or a range that is known, but the actual specific date is not known.
That sounds quite different to dendrochronology from, a building. It feels to me as if a ship should be built with timber that's all felled at one point. Because I'm used to things like the Sutton Hoo ship that has to be built out of green oak. Are you implying that this ship might have been built from timber that had been hanging around for a while, or does this represent mending?
We think it represents mending. So what you do have during the Seven Years' War, certainly, there is a lack of oak, and they are taking the oak out of the forests and they are putting it into ships almost immediately. And it doesn't get seasoned, which is really important for ship timbers. When the seasoning happens, when the timber starts to dry out and it starts to move, if that has happening within a ship, it's massively problematic. So you want to be able to season timber for a few years before using it in these ships. But in the Seven Years' War, there's not time. There's not enough oak. They need to build ships. They build them. They fall apart quite quickly. But they need the ships at the time. This ship's built before that, we think. But what you're seeing is potentially a very long-lived ship and it having to be repaired multiple times. So you have that sort of long
period. So you're getting more clues about the life of this ship just from the dendrochronology.
Exactly. And that's really useful because, again, we're not necessarily able to see the repair work. You can frequently often see repair work in timber shipwrecks, but in this case, we could see little pieces of it. But if they're ripping off the entirety of the outer planking and replacing it, then you're not necessarily going to see new planking going on there. At a time period when ships of this size are going long distances, they're potentially going into the tropics, and that is an area where you have very aggressive shipworm. They will eat through oak planks and damage ship's timbers in very little time. So if the ship spends 6 months or a year on the Caribbean station, for instance, in Jamaica, then they're going to have serious problems, and they will potentially have to have an almost a complete rebuild. And you see this within naval records at this point. You do get a lot of ships going for either, they're usually called grand repairs, that cost almost as much as building the ship in the first place, to just rip everything out and start again. But they've maintained the ship name through that.
So we have all this information then about this ship just from its timbers, which I think is amazing. Come on then, Ben, do the big reveal. What is this ship? What's its identity?
The key thing from Coralie's work was that she was able to identify it to a regional chronology, or to two regional chronologies, as it was, that all the timbers are coming from southern and southwestern England. And from a range of forests, it's not from one single source, it's from multiple sources. So that this ship is being built from a widespread selection of timber. And that suggests it's a relatively major ship. It's being used by a major organisation. We have suspicions, being in southwestern southern of England, that it's from the Royal Navy. We're very fortunate to have that enormous resource of the list of wrecks from the area. And we're very fortunate, actually, that it dated to the period it does, because it's when you start to get these massively more numbers of reported wrecks. We get more information about the wrecks. We have information from Lloyd's Register that we can start to work out where the ships in Sandy are coming from. And what you find is that there's five main locations that ships are coming from and going to within that area. And the first is very local, inter-island, small fishing vessels, flip boats going between the islands, this sort of stuff. We know it's not one of them. It's much bigger. It's much more complicated. And much more heavily built. You have vessels coming out of the Netherlands, northern Germany, and the Baltic, trading up either to Scotland or out into the North Atlantic and heading off to the various Indies or to the other locations they are trading with. We know it's not that because it's not built out of European timber or continental European timber, and England was not exporting any oak at this point. In fact, they're importing colossal amounts from the Baltic, and they're importing timbers from North America and the Caribbean as well. So it can't be any of them. You'll then start looking at other ships. Then you've got things like, there's a lot of West Coast, Irish Sea, West Coast of England, West Coast of Wales, the Clyde in Scotland as well. A lot of ships coming out of the Irish Sea, going over the top of Scotland and into the North Sea and Baltic as either coastal traders or long distance traders going into the Baltic for timber, for other materials. They would have been being built usually in their home ports. And again, we can find out where the home ports were due to Lloyd's Register. And they would have been being built from timber nearby, because oak is, a lot of the expense of shipbuilding oak is the transport from the forest to the shipyard. So they'd be more likely to be being built out of northern North English timber and Northwestern English timber in particular. So they are unlikely to be our vessels. And that removes a huge number of the possible wrecks we have. And the other one potentially is East Coast whalers. They're coming out of London or Hull or Whitby or the Eastern Scottish ports and going up to whale fishery in the Greenland Straits or the Davis Straits. And there are different possibilities. We've got four or five whaling vessels there. They're big ships. They're heavily built ships. We start to narrow down from that. So what you end up with is there are very, very few ships that are built in the south of England that wreck in Orkney at this time, or certainly that wreck around Sandy. And we end up with the last possible version of this option for this ship out of the 270 vessels that we've looked at being a whaler from London called the Earl of Chatham. And that is operating in Greenland and the Davis Straits. It's first registered in 1784. It has its first season there. It's registered in Lloyd's Register. And it wrecks in Sandy in March 1788. And that's very exciting because you have this huge number of wrecks. We have if this timber had been from northwestern England, if it had been from the Baltic or from from Northern Europe, we would have ended up with a list of 10-15 ships it could have been, and that's satisfying. We know it's from this area, and that's cool, and it demonstrates the trade and the exchange of Orkney. But to be able to sort of narrow it down to this shipwreck and then go through the history of this ship and still have it as the candidate is fantastic.
It really is fantastic. Coming up in a moment then, here on the Time Team podcast, you'll learn a little bit more from Ben about the ship and its role.
First, though, we'd like to draw your attention to the fact that Christmas is right around the corner. Now, I am always awful at buying my Christmas presents in advance. I usually find I miss the delivery deadlines and people just have to put up with things arriving on the 28th of December. How about you, Martin?
Yeah, I try and be organised. I do it by limiting the number of people that get presents from me. So it's a very, very select few people of just immediate family that will get presents, and I panic about every single one of them. So yes. I'm pretty terrible too.
Yes, I do keep lists, but they tend to be more lists for things that I'd like rather than anybody else. Stuart's just given me a recommendation for a book on the history of the Ordnance Survey and its maps, and I thought, ooh, wouldn't that be great for Angus? But actually, I'd quite like it for myself.
Well, look, if you're struggling for gift ideas for the Time Team fan, a history or archaeology buff in your life, there's actually a wonderful selection of unique presents over at the Time Team official shop.
Yes, and of course, the ultimate fan gift has got to be the Time Team membership. That's available to purchase as a gift subscription directly on the Patreon membership page. If you want that for yourself, by the way, right now we're offering you a free 7-day trial. So it's the perfect opportunity to experience the benefits of becoming a member. Head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
Yeah, do that. And if you like what you see there, then maybe you do want to gift that to somebody in your life who loves Time Team. If you're still looking for alternative gift ideas, or maybe something special for a fussy fan, or maybe you still need a couple of stocking fillers, we've got you covered for that as well. We've got t-shirts, fleeces, woolly hats, baseball caps in a variety of different colours, plus, and I know you're never far away from your one of these, Helen, the Time Team travel mug.
Yes, my travel mug, the yellow one, is absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's perfect for tea because it not only keeps the heat in, but it also keeps a perfectly good flavour, and it doesn't appear to stain. I mean, it's as yellow now as the day that I got it years ago. It's still as good as new.
Yeah, all of that then is available for you on the Time Team official shop. And as a little thank you and Merry Christmas from the team, you can now redeem a limited time offer with 10% off all items featuring in the stocking fillers collection in the shop until the end of December. And I know there's various little Christmas tree decorations which are there, which are really nice. I've got myself a Time Team bauble, which is on my tree this year. So it's got to, you know, pride of place.
Marvellous.
It's got to happen.
And all you've got to do to get the discount is to use the code TTChristmas at the checkout. That's TTChristmas, all one word. Now, Martin has said that I can try out my special advertisement voice here. So here we go. This offer is single use only and can't be combined with other membership offers. Standard shop T&Cs apply. How was that?
Top marks from me.
Thank you from the real radio professional. Lovely.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
It's Martin Williams and Helen Geek on a special edition of the Time Team podcast, where you're learning about the Sandaye wreck, a shipwreck found on a beach in Orkney last year. Let's head back to Ben Saunders, senior marine archaeologist at Wessex Archaeology.
So the Earl of Chatham, a whaler out of London, it doesn't seem to have had a very long life. You know, that's only 4 years between registry and wrecking. Is that it? What's the story?
So, again, I think you're right to say luck is a really important part of this, and not just the luck that we had in the work we did and the volunteers we were working with who had fantastic information and had provided so much help and assistance to the research, but also in terms of the ship itself. So Earl of Chatham is, if the first time it's registered, is 1784, and the Lloyd's Register for that point, they give the place it was built and the year it was built, although for Earl of Chatham it doesn't give the year. It has a blank space, which happens sometimes, and it has place of build as King's Yard. So King's Yard is what Deptford Royal Dockyard was previously called, and it came to mean all the Royal Dockyards during this period. So there's six Royal Dockyards, Deptford, Woolwich, Sheerness, Medway, on the Medway, Chatham also on the Medway, Portsmouth and Plymouth. And what we also now know is that it didn't just mean all those dockyards. It meant ships that were built by commercial firms and then brought into the dockyards for commissioning, because they would be finished off. They'd be built under naval supervision and under Admiralty supervision, and they would be then commissioned in a Royal Dockyard. So that means tick, they're fine. They're still built in a King's Yard. So we know what we're dealing with is a previously a naval vessel, but we don't know which, because we haven't got the build year. And that's infuriating, because at the end of the American War of Revolutionary War, there is a massive glut of ships being sold out of the Royal Navy. And it's a very popular thing for whaling firms to buy them, because they're very strong, they're very well built, they're good ships to use as whalers, and they're quite cheap because they've had a long life and the Navy's just looking to recoup what they can. And this is a feature of maritime activity during the 18th century, is you have conflict and that reduces trade, or it reduces these other activities like whaling, because all the mariners are needed, and it's a dangerous thing to do when you have enemies who can pop up at any point in the sea and take your investment and take your ship. And then at the end of the war, there's a massive rise in these activities again, because you've got lots of mariners who are leaving the Navy and need a job, money. Not that they're paid very often by the Navy or by their employers either. And you have this vast number of ships, and suddenly this economic drive to go out and get stuff. So the early 1780s is actually a real boom period for whaling, sadly for the whales. And then it completely collapses, interestingly, in 1788, because there's just too much material coming in, too many people, too many ships trying to go and get it.
So the whaling collapses in 1788?
It's a complete bust year for the industry. There's massive amounts of money lost in 1788, both through because ships are lost, or including the Earl of Chatham, but because they've overfished. It's one of the many periods there's just not enough whales, and that you go from a period in the late 1770s when a total of 40 vessels are going to the Arctic for whaling, to 1787, London alone is sending over 100 vessels.
I mean, one of the things that I want to ask is how did it... I've never stopped before to think, how did it work with whaling and ships? Do you kill a whale and drag it back to... tow it back to port? Can you do more than one whale in a journey?
Yeah, so we have the records from Ola Chatham show that each year that was taking multiple whales. I think this most successful year it hunts and kills 7 whales. And what you do on these vessels, this is before you have the tri-works on board, the blubber boiling down cauldrons that they put on board ships, particularly the American ships, from the turn of the 19th century onwards. What you're actually doing is you're going up to the Greenland seas with a ship full of either empty barrels or barrels you are using for your food or for your other rations. And then as you catch a whale, they are dragged next to the ship. And the reason that the species they're mostly hunting is called the Greenland right whale. And the reason it's called the right whale is because it is the right whale to hunt. Because when you kill them, they float. They don't just sink straight away. So you harpoon your whale, if you are so inclined, and drag it next to the ship. And you start to flens off the blubber. You and your crew start to flens off the blubber, cut it into slabs that fit into a barrel, pack it into a barrel with salt, put those down into the hold, seal them up, and then you go back to, in this case, the Thames. And there is an enormous processing station at Rotherhithe in the Greenland dock with tri-works and all this sort of material that to break it down into the oil that is then used for lubrication in machinery. It's powering the early Industrial Revolution. London has the first streetlights using whale oil, I believe. That may or may not be wrong. But I believe that has the first streetlights using whale oil. And it's this material is all sort of brought back. So this is what Earl of Chatham is doing. But it's interesting, in its previous life, we know it was a naval vessel of some kind. And the Aberdeen Journal, when it sinks, does note that this ship was a frigate of the last war. So that would suggest it's a frigate. But unfortunately, newspapers, certainly in the past, are not necessarily always true. And they have a habit of, at this point, absolute fury of the Royal Navy, calling every single ship they can a frigate. So it doesn't necessarily mean it is a frigate. It could be a bomb vessel, it could be a sloop, it could be a smaller vessel. But we can start looking.
Yes, because at this point, you're starting to track down what that ship was before it became the Earl of Chatham, because you don't think that it was, if it wasn't newly built in 1784, what was it before? Did it have a greater history?
Exactly, and we have to do that. It's really important for us to do that, because we it's still a possibility that the Ola Chatham is this shipwreck, but it's also a possibility it's not. If it's coming out, if we find out that it's the information from the naval sources gives it as a wrong, means it can't be the ship we're looking for, then that scuppers us, and we have to go back to saying, well, we don't know which vessel it is. So we're going through looking at the archive information we can for Earl of Chatham and for the naval vessels that are sold out of the Royal Navy during the 1780s. And there's a huge number, and a lot of them do become whalers, or they are bought as heavy trading vessels, or they're bought to convert into slave vessels. Because all of these industries are all wrapped up together. The same people who are the ship owners who are doing whaling also have interest in slaving quite often. Calvey and Company out of East London, massively into slaving and into whaling, and then convert their ships to be some of the first ships to take convicts to Australia. Anyway, horrible people doing all sorts of nasty things. What we end up doing is we're looking through the archives for this material, and we find that there is a Board of Trade register of foreign destination shipping from 1787. Very lucky, considering the Earl of Chatham sinks in 1788. And this collates all of the information the Board of Trade needs to know about vessels, going to foreign places. And this is specifically there so they can have an idea of the numbers of vessels they need to potentially protect if there is another large global conflict. And we find the information for the Earl of Chatham in here. And it says Earl of Chatham was built in Chichester, in the county of Sussex, in 1749. And that doesn't tell us who it's built for, it doesn't tell us what that is, but we know it's a Royal Naval vessel. So we can go back and have a look through the Navy list for the time. And the only ship that matches that is HMS Hind, which was a 6th or 8th frigate built in the West Itchener Yard of Chitty and Vernon in 1749, started in 1748, launched in 1749. And that's then confirmed quite nicely. There's a letter from the owners of the vessel to the Admiralty saying, we need to fill in this register for the Board of Trade. We haven't got any information about when this ship was built. Could you confirm that it is HMS Hind and when that was built? And the Admiralty write back saying, yes, it's HMS Hind. It was built by this firm in 1749. Please stop writing to us.
And it matches perfectly with the Dendro, doesn't it? That's
very, very nicely. So we have that one timber that spring 1748. That's a good amount of time. It's not ideal, but it's a good amount of time for it to start seasoning a little bit and then get into the hull. And also, it has time to season when it's in the hull before it gets launched. And then the later timbers, it does match with either the known repair schedule that the ship went through. So Hind has a major repair in 1774, although that's mostly to do with the upper works. From what we can see in the naval records, it's basically saying that most of the sort of second and third futtocks and the framing further up the hull has all started to break down and become rat-eaten. But it spends a lot of time in the 1750s on the Jamaican station, where it is likely to be damaged by shipworm. And there is a period in the late 1750s, early 1760s, when it looks like the ship goes for a repair. It's not absolutely certain. There's not great repair records from the late 1750s for a variety of reasons. But it looks like there's a point when it comes back from being on the North American station, where it is taking part in the naval exercises as part of the Siege of Louisbourg and the Siege of Quebec during the Seven Years' War. It comes back to probably Plymouth, maybe Portsmouth, and has a relatively major repair to the lower parts of the hull at that point, which would match with the other dates we have of definite fellings, which are all sort of late 1750s. So yeah, it matches really nicely. And so it's still a possibility. That ship is built in the south of England. It's repaired repeatedly in the southwest of England from a variety of different sources, which matches with naval practices. And then we're also very fortunate to have the ship plans for HMS Hind's class. So it's part of the 1745 establishment, which is a ship design set out for 1745. Six ships are built on that standard. Although, interestingly, the two built by Chitty and Vernon in Chichester are slightly shorter. We're not absolutely certain why. They're about 2.5 feet shorter, but that's what they're doing. It's what potentially they adapt the plans because they think they know better. And we have those plans.
It's always the way.
We have those plans, which is fantastic. So we can compare the 3D model that was made of the wreck before we took it apart, which was a really important thing to have to understand the shape of the vessel and understand what was there. One of the guys in Sandy fantastically took a load of photos of the wreck for photogrammetry because they're a marine surveyor. And then we were able to get those photos, process them to make a full 3D model of that wreck, and then compare those to the hull sections of this plan, and also compare them to the lines drawings that sort of show how well it matches the curves of the hull and the shape of the hull. And it also really demonstrates how small a piece of this huge ship we actually have.
It does seem incredible that you've got such an amazing community in Sandy with all those amazing skills.
Yeah, they've been fantastic.
I'm realising that there are two things that we haven't really talked about, though. One is that's always in the top of people's minds, I think, when you know about a shipwreck, which is what happened to the people who were on that ship when it wrecked. The other thing is what happened in 1788? What was the incident that led to it being shipwrecked? Do you know? Was it weather? Was it...
We think it's weather. So the ship is sailing out of London, going up to Greenland for this trip. It leaves London in February, and by March it's for summer of Orkney. It's the first year that it's got a new master. So for the previous seasons, it's had a captain called William Brown, who's a very experienced whaling captain. He goes to the Davis Straits on the west side of Greenland to hunt whales. He comes back with multiple whales each year. He does very well. He's then later involved in an escapade called the Butterworth Expedition, where he takes three ships around to the Pacific Northwest and gets involved in all sorts of killing. There's just lots more death, horrible people. They get involved in local wars and decide to, we get really involved in local wars.
I'll have to look that up.
It's just, there's lots of very unpleasant things connected to this ship, but the stories are really interesting. New captain under Charles Patterson in 1788. It's his first voyage. We think potentially, because he comes up, he wrecked in Sandy, we think potentially he's going up to the Greenland seas on the east of Greenland, because ships that are going to the Davis Straits tend to go through the Pentland Firth and call it Stromness in the west of Orkney, and the ones that are going to the Greenland seas tend to go and call it Lerwick in Shetland. There is a record of this ship going ashore in March, late March, possibly in a storm. There is a story, bit of local folklore recorded by Walter Trail Denison, who's a Sandy folklorist, which says that the crew blamed a local woman who was known as a sea witch, Ship Maggie, for the wreck. The crew, when they were coming ashore, they all survived, all 56 of them. The mate saw Ship Maggie walking down the track, and she was known as a woman who wore one white shoe and one black shoe, and he wanted to attack her because he'd seen her dancing on the forepeak, on the foremast, during the storm, and that's why they'd wrecked. And so he was absolutely certain that this woman he hadn't seen before, apart from apparently up at the top of the mast during the storm, had wrecked his ship. And that's what, yeah, we think it was a storm that wrecked it, probably not a storm witch was the cause of the wreck. And that, yes, all the crew survived. Again, we're talking about what we actually think is actually quite a lucky ship. It does wreck, but all the crew survive, and it wrecks in Sandy, which is quite widely known as quite a good place to wreck, even, and quite a common place to wreck, which is fortunate. So it's good that it's both a place that everyone wrecks and a good place to wreck. And we know this from tales that are in the old statistical accounts of Scotland from the minister who is in charge of Sandy and North Ronaldsay, or this part of Sandy and North Ronaldsay, and he records how it's unusual that such a place that has so many wrecks is known as somewhere who also looks after people. You have captains of ships from Danzig, now Gdansk, saying, thank you so much for looking after me, thank you for looking after my crew, here's a gift of some material for your time. There's a captain who says, if I was to be wrecked anywhere, I would want it to be Sandy. And part of that is because lots of people do survive, because it's quite you're not smashing yourself against rocks and cliffs. You're being driven ashore onto sandy beaches, and you have potentially got the time to actually get off your ship and get ashore. And so, yeah, it's known as a place that's actually quite good to be wrecked on, and quite common to be wrecked on. So, yeah.
So this concludes then with almost a happy ending. I mean, the ship has wrecked, so it's not a great ending, but everybody survives, which is kind of quite a nice way to round this off, I think. And how much, I think it's incredible just how much you've been able to tell us, Ben, and how much we've been able to learn about this ship from just that tiny discovery of what essentially looks like a few planks of wood on a beach on an island in the Orkneys. I think that is fascinating.
Yeah, that's a big shout out to Dendrochronology, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Dendrochronology did a fantastic job. And I mean, I do need to say this is thanks to all the hard work that the volunteers took part in the project, and all the population of Sandy have been fantastic. They've learned a lot from us. They've taught us an awful lot about shipwrecks in Sandy as well. It's not just been me telling people about things. It's been a proper knowledge exchange of what's going on. The overall project was funded by Historical About Scotland and by Orkney Archaeological Society as well. And throughout the project, it's been really good. One of the reasons that HES are so interested in it is because there are one of the reasons this shipwreck was found was due to the increased storminess and the changes that are coming through with climate change. And therefore, there is potential for this material to become more frequently found around Scotland's coasts. HES have published a dealing with climate change guide for historic material, particularly looking at marine archaeology and intertidal archaeology. And that's been incredibly useful to us while we've been doing this project. And I think also, hopefully, this project has demonstrated the significance of that work and the importance of it going forward. One of the reasons we've been doing this is to increase capacity within Orkney, within Sandy in particular, so that if this material was found again, or similar material is found again, it can be recorded rapidly by the population before we have time to get up there. It takes a chunk of time for people to get to Orkney. Not as long as it took in the 17th century, but still a bit of time. And it's been a fantastic project overall to work on.
Ben, that has been an amazing tale and wonderfully told as well. So thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it.
No problem. Thank you guys very much. It's been my pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much to Ben Saunders, Senior Marine Archaeologist at Wessex Archaeology. If you want to learn even more about the Sandy wreck and see some photos of the work done to recover parts of it, then Wessex have put it up on their website. If you just search Sandy wreck, it's going to be the first thing that comes up.
That's it from me and Helen on this edition of the podcast, but you just wait until next week. In a really special pre-Christmas treat for you, we're bringing you an entire podcast chatting to Sir Tony Robinson. It's so exciting.
Yes, we'll be talking about his new book, The House of Wolf, his time team memories, what got him interested in archaeology in the first place, and how much he's learned about it over years and years of learning from the best in the business.
Honestly, it is not to be missed. Exactly what you need for a cozy night in front of the fire, I think. Very Christmassy. That episode is also going up on our YouTube channel as well, so you can watch it as well.
We're really looking forward to that, and we'll speak to you next week on the Time Team podcast.
Bye-bye.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.